Today we're going to study what the Bible says about the sin of Jeroboam. What was the sin of Jeroboam? I imagine that most of you probably know the answer to that question, but I suspect that if we were to do a man on the street interview with Christians and ask them that question, I have a feeling that many would have a hard time answering that question. And some might even say it's not very important or that it doesn't matter what it was. Some might not even know who Jeroboam was. Yet, as Scripture details the northern kingdom of Israel's descent into full-scale idolatry, God's inspired record of its kings repeats this phrase about the sin of Jeroboam over and over and over again, telling how each king either embraced the sin of Jeroboam or failed to stop it from continuing in Israel. So, since Scripture continually reminds us about the sin of Jeroboam, it should be obvious that we should also know what it is, right? All right, well, that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to look at this and try to gain a greater appreciation of all that was involved with it and how it affected Israel and how God judged it as well. So as I started preparing for this message, I sat down and I was wondering whether I was going to have enough material to make a whole message. And I figured I probably would, but the longer I sat down, the more I researched, I ended up with two messages. So, trust me, I didn't intend for that. It's just that there's actually so much background and detail to really understand what's going on. It's going to take two messages to actually go through it all. And probably next week I'll also talk about some of the applications that we can learn as well. So, what was the sin of Jeroboam? The short answer to that question is that Jeroboam devised a religion in which he and his northern kingdom of Israel worshipped the Lord on their terms, not God's terms. Okay? So, Jeroboam led Israel, the northern kingdom, into a religion that worshipped Yahweh, that worshipped the Lord on their terms, not God's terms. If you were to put it into one word, it's the word syncretism, okay? They wanted to worship Yahweh, at least that's what they said they were doing. They just didn't want to worship Yahweh the way that he had prescribed. They thought they had a better way to worship him. Well, the Lord is God, and we are created by him. Because he is God and we are not, we absolutely must worship God for who he is and what he has done, and we must do it on his terms, not on our terms. God has a right to instruct us how we are to worship him, and when we refuse to worship him the way he says we should, we are guilty of a very serious sin. Now, to discover the details of Jeroboam's sin, let's begin by looking at Israel's descent into idolatry, which, shockingly and very sadly, was led by David's own son, Solomon. Please open your Bibles to 1 Kings 11, verse 4. 1 Kings 11, verse 4. Please follow along with me as I read. 1 Kings 11, 4 says, "As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, and as the heart of David his father had been." Now notice the gods that he's worshiping. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. Okay, so you see these gods that he's been worshiping, Ashtoreth, Molech, Chemosh. Okay, we're going to come back and we're going to see that those names come up again. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Now skip down to verse 26. For those of you who came in just a little late, we're looking at the sin of Jeroboam tonight. The sin of Jeroboam and how it affected Israel and what God did about it. Okay, so verse 26. Also, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zeredah, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. Here is the account of how he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the supporting terraces and had filled in the gap in the wall of the city of David, his father. Now notice what it says about Jeroboam. Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. Okay, so here we see at least four things. First of all, Jeroboam was one of Solomon's officials. Okay, he worked in a leadership capacity. Secondly, we see that he was from Ephraim. Ephraim, the leading tribe of the 10 northern tribes. And what we're going to see here throughout this message, actually, is that Ephraim was very much affected by idolatry. And then thirdly, he was a man of standing. A man of standing. That is, he was a very talented and capable man. In fact, Jeroboam did such a good job that Solomon saw it and promoted him to be a leader over the building works of Jerusalem. So Jeroboam was a rising star of Israel. He was a man who was full of potential and great ability. And it's one of the things that we'll see. Now look at verse 29. It says, about that time Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah the prophet of Shiloh met him on the way wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, will have one tribe. Why does God do this? He tells us in the next section. I will do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. Those gods look familiar. So there we see Solomon wasn't the only one who was engaged in idolatry. Yes, he was doing it for his wife's sake, but there were also other Israelites who were engaged in this idolatry, and that was why God was bringing this judgment upon Israel. Then he says, but I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life, for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose and whom I have observed my commands and statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. However, as for you, Jeroboam, I will take you and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you, and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David and will give Israel to you. So this is really staggering, as I mentioned this last week. But when you think about it, it's really remarkable that God makes Jeroboam the same promise he made to David and Solomon, that if he obeyed God, that God would also give him a dynasty. Very fascinating. Then God says, I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever. Now this implies that this division was not intended to be permanent. but that David's descendants would one day rule over a united Israel once again. That was God's intention. And we know, in fact, that that will happen in the future. It will indeed happen when Jesus rules over a united Israel once again. Well, God tells Jeroboam there would be a tribal, geographical, and political division of Israel, and that Jeroboam would become the leader over the northern tribes. God also tells them that he is doing this because of Israel's idolatry. It is important to note that this division was not to be a religious division. So it was divided in many ways, but the religion was not to be changed. The religion was not to be divided. God still expected both kings of both kingdoms to worship him and worship him alone. That's what God expected. Well, as we know, as we read it previously, Solomon apparently found out about this prophecy because verse 40 says, Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt to Shishak the king and stayed there until Solomon's death. So, observe, this will come into play as well. Notice that he went to Egypt. So Jeroboam went to Egypt and spent a fair amount of time there until Solomon died. Now look at chapter 12, verse 1. Chapter 12, verse 1. We mentioned this last week. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. Shechem is a town in the hill country of northern Ephraim, 30 miles north of Jerusalem. Okay? So notice it's in the territory of Ephraim. So a lot of the power in the north, the most influential tribe was Ephraim. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, then it says he was still in Egypt where he had fled from King Solomon. It says when he heard this, he returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, that is the northern tribe sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you. Remember, we talked about how Solomon not only taxed the people, he also had forced labor to build the temple and other buildings, and people were really worn out with all this. They were sick and tired of the heavy burden, the yoke that Solomon had put upon them. Well, Rehoboam answered, go away for 3 days and then come back to me. So the people went away. Now skip down to verse 12. It says, 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam as the king had said, come back to me in 3 days. I believe the idea here is that Jeroboam is essentially the leader of the group, and he's representing their grievances and wanting them to know, wanting Rehoboam to know that he needs to listen to them. Now the king answered the people harshly, rejecting the advice given him by the elders. He followed the advice of the young men and said, my father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord. To fulfill the word of the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah the Shilonite. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, what share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, O David. So the Israelites went home. I think we talked about last week that these words sound familiar because this is the same rallying cry which Sheba had said when he led a revolt of the northern tribes against David in the past. They said, what share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? And so now they're using those same words, except now it's serious business in a greater way, a serious division that's going on here. Now look at verse 20. It reads, when all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, so he'd returned from Egypt, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Summary. What have we learned about from this section? Well, Solomon's former servant turned enemy Jeroboam returns to Israel after Solomon's death and is a leader of an opposition group to the new king, Rehoboam. And the northerners he is with are disgruntled over Solomon's oppressive governance, which Rehoboam foolishly decides he not only is going to continue, but increase. This decision provides Jeroboam with his opportunity to be the new king over these 10 northern tribes. Keyword, new. New. Whole lot of new stuff going on with Jeroboam at this time. He is the brand new king over a newly restructured nation of Israel. So since all of this was new, why not add some more new things, right? You know how presidents and leaders, they like to jam as much change as they can immediately when they first take over? Well, that's what Jeroboam does. He says, okay, we've got a new kingdom. I'm the new king. Well, guess what? I'm going to make some changes. And he does. Verse 25. He starts with a new capital city. It says, then Jeroboam fortified Shechem, where? In the hill country of Ephraim, and lived there. Okay, he was from Ephraim. It was a center of power in the north. And Shechem becomes the capital. And then he says, from there he went out and built up Peniel or Penuel. And hey, while we're at it, let's start a new, updated, more user-friendly religion to freshen things up a bit. After all, that old Mosaic religion has gotten kind of stale, don't you think? I mean, we've been doing it a long time now. And so verse 26, Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam. You know what? If you take God out of the equation, he's right. He's right. That's what would happen, most likely. But remember, what did he have? He had God. God said, if you will obey me and follow my commands. So here we see Jeroboam was not a believer in God. He was not following what God had promised him. He did not believe God when God promised to take care of him and give him a dynasty. Immediately, the first thing he does is think up, oh, I've got to come up with a way to keep everyone from going back to Rehoboam. Here we see Jeroboam's motive for his changes to their religious system. It was to protect his own throne. This is important. He wasn't making changes because God told him to. He wasn't doing it because he really believed God's word and he thought this would improve things. As far as we can tell, he wasn't even doing it because he believed in it. No, it was just plain old self-preservation. Jeroboam led a whole nation into idolatry out of fear that he would lose his throne. He feared that if his people continued to worship in Jerusalem, then they would eventually go back to Rehoboam. You remember how King Saul essentially went mad because he got so afraid of David stealing his throne? This was a tendency of kings. They would get power and they'd become strong and then they start worrying about everybody trying to steal their throne. Well, this was what was going on with Jeroboam here. Right off the bat, he wants to secure his kingdom. Verse 28. After seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. Observe that Jeroboam sought advice and that this was the counsel that he must have received. What does that tell you? It means that he wasn't the only one who thought it was a good idea. In fact, as we'll see, this idolatrous mindset was already a part of the culture in the northern kingdom. So it wasn't like the northern tribes were devoted to worshiping Yahweh, and then this dynamic new king imposes idolatry upon everyone against their will. No, there were already areas among the northern tribes where people had been into idolatry. Now they finally have a king who has made it the centerpiece of his religion. He's giving many of them what they want. Now then, what do we know about these two golden calves? Well, some good scholars that I respect believe that each calf represented a pedestal upon which Yahweh stood. But I'm not sure that's correct, because the evidence, what the Bible actually says, is that they were worshiping the calf, not a pedestal upon which Yahweh stood. I think it is more likely that Jeroboam presented a bull, the bull, as symbolizing Yahweh, because he may have been influenced by Egyptian calf worship, since he had lived quite a while in Egypt. Remember that? Mentioned that earlier. He had just come from Egypt. And it is possible that he got the idea there. Also, archaeology has shown that the nations around Israel also incorporated calves into their worship as well. So it could have come from either of those places. I did come across a really good article, which I thought was pretty compelling, which argued this way. This calf worship was not what we normally think of as idolatry. That is, when we think of idolatry, we think of worshiping other gods like Baal or Molech or Chemosh. No, this is an attempt to worship Yahweh. That's right. The claim is that they're still worshiping Yahweh, but now they're worshiping Yahweh on their own terms, not on Yahweh's terms, which he spells out in the Mosaic Law. There must have been some of them who were sick and tired of worshiping Yahweh on what they considered to be narrow, rigid terms. What did Yahweh command? Well, guess what? One location, Jerusalem. And you know, that is a long way to travel. Remember, they didn't have cars back in those days. It wasn't convenient at all. Seriously, it is way down in the south. Why did the northern tribes always have to do all the traveling anyway? And there was one temple. Why can't there be multiple places of worship? There was just one priesthood, the Levites. What's so great about the Levites anyway? Why can't anyone become a priest if he wants? You know, I've known a few Levites, and you know, I've known a few other people from other tribes that actually were more serious about God than some of those Levites I've known. I'm not so sure that they should be the priests. Beyond this, Yahweh is an invisible God, and they were not even allowed to make any images to this invisible God. You know, it's hard to worship an invisible God. No doubt, complaints like this had been around the northern kingdom for many, many years. By making these calves, Jeroboam is saying that Israel can worship Yahweh the way they want to worship him. In flagrant disobedience to God's command not to make or worship any graven images. Look at verse 28. Jeroboam said to the people, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." Look at what Jeroboam says. "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem." Similar saying, but slightly different. In the ESV, it says, "You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough." You know, essentially he's saying, you know, it's so inconvenient. It's such a long trip. Not centrally located, I mean seriously. And then he says, "Here are your gods who brought you up out of Egypt." Now, we really need to get this. Jeroboam was not claiming to start a religion of worshiping other gods. No, Israel wasn't ready yet to completely leave the worship of Yahweh for another god. Jeroboam started a religion of worshiping Yahweh with these golden calves, and somehow each calf is supposed to represent Yahweh. Jeroboam's new religion was syncretistic. He blended elements of Yahweh worship with elements of paganism and claimed that he was worshiping Yahweh. This is exactly what God forbid in the book of Deuteronomy. God says this, "After the inhabitants have been destroyed before you, inhabitants of Canaan have been destroyed before you, be careful not to be ensnared by inquiring about their gods, saying, 'How do these nations serve their gods? We will do the same.' You must not worship the Lord your God in their way." And then he ends by saying, "See that you do all I command you. Do not add to it or take away from it." A good article I found online says this. Jeroboam did not rush wholesale into apostasy, the worship of a foreign god. Instead, he merely made things a little easier for Israel to worship the God of Abraham. Such gradual change is typically the pattern of apostasy, and we must always be on guard against it. I thought that was very, very appropriate. Now, here's something interesting. Jeroboam's new religion wasn't actually new. You know, one thing about Satan, he is a master of selling repackaged lies to people and making them think that it's really new and flashy and fun, when actually it's just a repackaged version of something that's old and stupid. He's really good at that. Really good. You know, a lot of the movements and changes within church, as you study churches and the changes that go on a lot of times, a lot of things that happen, it's like people are so enamored with certain things, and then, you know, 10 years later, nobody cares at all about that. They look back and they say, well, why were you guys doing that? I don't know. You know? Well, Satan is really good at making old lies look like they're really new and exciting. Oh, man, you don't want to be old-fashioned. You can't believe that old religion. You've got to go on to this new stuff. Well, incredibly, when Jeroboam presented his calves to Israel, he used the same words which Israel had said long before when they had just come out of Egypt. Exodus says this, Aaron took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then he said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. No sooner had Israel left Egypt, they were already syncretizing their religion. Isn't that amazing? Remarkable. So, what is Jeroboam doing? He is simply taking up where Israel had left off before they had committed themselves to the Mosaic law on Mount Sinai. He's saying, yes, we're going to worship Yahweh, but not the way that Moses prescribed. We're going to worship him the way our ancestors originally wanted to worship him. And so this newly elected king over this newly reconstructed nation sets up his new capital with its new system of worship, and then he designates not just one new worship location, but two. Verse 29 says, one bull he set up in Bethel, and the other bull in Dan. And this thing became a sin that the people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. So there's a hint of irony here, okay? So some of the people who didn't necessarily live all the way up in the north, who complained about having to travel all the way to Jerusalem to worship, they were traveling all the way up to Dan to worship the bull, okay? I think there's a sense of irony there. They went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. Now then, why did Jeroboam place an altar in Bethel and Dan? Well, if I were to show you a map of Israel, there's one obvious reason, okay? Dan is the northernmost city in Israel. Bethel is one of the southernmost cities in Israel, just above the border of Judah, only 11 miles north of Jerusalem, on the main north-south road going from the northern kingdom down to Jerusalem. So, Bethel and Dan were strategic, convenient, and religiously significant locations. Since Bethel was located on the main road to Jerusalem, it meant that the only people who would still go to the temple in Jerusalem were those who had already decided, I'm not going to the one in Bethel. They had to be determined to go to Jerusalem, basically. Anyone who is not really determined to worship at Jerusalem would find it much easier to worship at Bethel because it was so convenient. Bethel was also revered because Jacob had worshiped there. Remember the patriarch Jacob, the one from whom Israel gets its name? And it was Jacob, think about this, it was Jacob who actually named it Bethel. And guess what the name Bethel means? House of God. So, What better place to have a place of worship than the place where the patriarch Jacob himself built an altar and called that the house of God? So Bethel is a no-brainer for all kinds of reasons, strategically, conveniently, historically, and religiously. That one's the obvious one. But what about Dan? Why, out of all the northern towns, why did he pick Dan? Well, in the book of Judges, we see that that Jeroboam's system actually bears some similarities to something that was going on during the book of Judges in the tribe of Dan. Please turn your Bibles to Judges 17. Judges 17. When you read the book of Judges and you're reading through, it almost seems like chapter 17 and 18 are like something that was just inserted into the book and you can't figure out why they're there. Well, actually, they're later on, as you study the rest of the Old Testament, you start seeing why they're there. And I believe that what we've learned about Jeroboam with his worship ties directly within it, and it helps us to make sense of that. So that's at least one of the reasons why it's there. It says, "Now a man named Micah from the hill country of Ephraim." Aha! Notice that? He's from the hill country of Ephraim. Where was Jeroboam from? He was from Ephraim. Very good. And where was the group? A lot of the power base ends up in the hill country of Ephraim. Okay. Well, so Micah said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, and about which I heard you utter a curse, I have that silver with me. I took it." Then his mother said, "The Lord bless you, my son." You really need to catch that, okay? Because Micah and his mother believe that they are worshiping the Lord. They believe they're worshiping Yahweh, okay? But let's see what it says here. "When he returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, she said, 'I solemnly consecrate my silver to Yahweh, to the Lord, for my son to make a carved image and a cast idol.'" Shocking, isn't it? We know that doesn't work. You don't say, "I'm going to solemnly consecrate this to Yahweh, an invisible God who has commanded you not to make graven images." What this is showing us is that this household of Micah was already doing this syncretized religion stuff. Okay? "So he returned the silver to his mother, and she took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to a silversmith who made them into the image and the idol, and they were put in Micah's house. Now, this man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and some idols and installed one of his sons as his priest." Now, there's something innovative. You know, "Man, I need a priest. Okay, hey, Johnny, I know you're only 16 years old, but how about you be my priest?" Or whatever, however old he was. Can you imagine making your son your priest? I mean, pretty remarkable. And then it says, "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit." So that's the refrain through the book of Judges that just reminds you it was kind of like the Wild Wild West. People were just making it up as they went along. And that's what was happening here. So here we see that during the period of the Judges, some people in the tribe of Dan weren't following the law of Moses, but instead, they were syncretistic, combining the worship of Yahweh with paganism, worshiping Yahweh the way they wanted to worship him. They ignored God's command not to make graven image and did it anyway, thinking they could worship Yahweh using those images, and instead of recognizing Levites as the only ones who could be priests, they made priests out of whoever was willing. Okay? Well, the story doesn't end there. Let's continue in verse 7. It says, "A young Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, who had been living within the clan of Judah, left that town in search of some other place to stay. On his way, he came to Micah's house in the hill country of Ephraim. Micah asked him, 'Where are you from?' 'I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah,' he said, 'and I'm looking for a place to stay.' Then Micah said to him, 'Live with me and be my father and priest, and I'll give you 10 shekels of silver a year, your clothes and your food.' So the Levite agreed to live with him, and the young man was to him like one of his sons. Then Micah installed the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in his house. And Micah said, "Now I know that Yahweh will be good to me since this Levite has become my priest." Okay. What do we see here? We see that although this man from Dan, which is very significant, Micah's from the tribe of Dan. We're going to see how significant that is in a little bit. So this man from Dan named Micah thought it was okay to make his own son to be his priest. He still understood that God's priests were actually the Levites. So it wasn't that he didn't know that. It was that he still thought he could worship God on his own terms. He thought he didn't have to really follow that. And when this Levite from Judah comes around, Micah says, "Hey, I can now upgrade my priest. I can get a priest upgrade. You know, I don't have to have, you know, this thing, you know, people question whether my son's legit. Now I can get someone who's legit, a real Levite." Okay? And he's even from Bethlehem, which is close to Jerusalem. So Yahweh will surely be good to me. Okay, now keep reading in chapter 18, verse 1. "In those days, Israel had no king. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking a place of their own where they might settle, because they had not yet come into an inheritance among the tribes of Israel." Okay, that's bad news if you're the people living in that area, because you've got a bunch of people who need a place to live, and they're looking for someone to conquer, okay? We'll see that in a little bit. "So the Danites sent 5 warriors from Zorah and Eshtaol to spy out the land and explore it. These men represented all their clans." Very important to see that, okay? So these men who were these warriors, okay, they represented all the clans of the Danites. They told them, "Go explore the land." The men entered the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah, where they spent the night. So there you see Micah's house is in the hill country of Ephraim. "When they were near Micah's house, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. So they turned in there and asked him, 'Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? Why are you here?' He told them what Micah had done for him and said, 'He has hired me and I am his priest.'" See, this guy Micah, he had his own personal priest. Amazing. "Then they said to him, 'Please inquire of God to learn whether our journey will be successful.' The priest answered them, 'Go in peace. Your journey has Yahweh's approval.'" So important for us to see, this priest claims to be a priest of Yahweh, even though God, as we know, wasn't the one who made him one. He was just kind of like a self-made priest almost. "So the 5 men left and came to Laish, where they saw that the people were living in safety like the Sidonians, unsuspecting and secure. And since their land lacked nothing, they were prosperous." Easy pickings is what they're thinking. "Also, they lived a long way from the Sidonians and had no relationship with anyone else. So nobody's going to come and rescue them when they destroy the town. When they returned to Zorah and Eshtaol, their brothers asked them, 'How did you find things?' They answered, 'Come on, let's attack them. We have seen that the land is very good. Aren't you going to do something? Don't hesitate to go there and take it over. When you get there, you will find an unsuspecting people and a spacious land that God has put into your hands, a land that lacks nothing whatever.' Then 600 men from the clan of the Danites, armed for battle, set out for Zorah and Eshtaol." Okay, so they sack the place. Now go down to verse 18. "When these men went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the other household gods, and the cast idol, the priest said to them, 'What are you doing?' They answered him, 'Be quiet, don't say a word.'" Now notice what they do. Here's 600 men. They're representing all the tribe of Dan throughout. And they say, "Come with us and be our father and priest. Isn't it better that you serve a tribe and clan in Israel as priest rather than just one man's household?" Then the priest was glad. And I suspect he might have been somewhat glad because it meant he wasn't going to die, which he was probably worried about, I'm guessing. But the priest was glad. He took the ephod, the other household gods, and the carved image and went along with the people. So what we see here, and I believe that the book of Judges is trying to show us, is that this syncretized form of worship was not limited to just Micah. But it actually spread, or had already spread to some degree, or was acceptable to the whole tribe of Dan. Now skip down to verse 27. Then they took what Micah had made and his priest and went on to Laish against a peaceful and unsuspecting people. I'm sorry, I got my warfare in the wrong place there. Here's the warfare. They attacked them with the sword and burned down their city. There was no one to rescue them because they lived a long way from Sidon and had no relationship with anyone else. The city was in a valley near Beth Rehob. Then it says, the Danites rebuilt the city and settled there. They named it Dan after their forefather Dan, who was born to Israel, though the city used to be called Laish. So this is actually God's record of how the city of Laish became the city of Dan. It is how the city of Dan originated. Now look at verse 30, because verse 30 tells us how the religion of Dan started. It says, there the Danites set up for themselves the idols, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, that's right, Moses' grandson, and his sons were priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. And from what I read, that was hundreds of years. They continued to use the idols Micah had made all the time the house of God was in Shiloh. So, do you see why Jeroboam chose the city of Dan as the northern location for his new system of worship? It is because this paganized form of Yahweh worship was very deeply rooted there. The false worship at Dan had opposed the true worship of the Lord at Shiloh for generations, starting with none other than the grandson of Moses, whose name was Jonathan. He and his sons even served it as a family of priests. So the city of Dan is also a religiously significant place for Jeroboam's worship. Now, we have a new king over a newly restructured kingdom with a new capital and a couple new worship sites with a couple new golden calf images. But wait, that's not all. There's even more new things. Check out verse 31. It says, Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. Sound familiar? Same stuff that was going on in the book of Judges. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the month, like the festival held in Judah. Here we see that Jeroboam made Yahweh worship as convenient as possible by not just restricting worship to Bethel and Dan. He set up less important worship spots on high places throughout Israel, which was a common practice even before, going all the way back to the book of Genesis. Okay, the rest of the Old Testament tells us that these high places were a spot of idolatry for the rest of Israel's existence. He also instituted his own priesthood system, ignoring God's restriction of it to the Levites. Instead, Jeroboam selected priests from among the various tribes. Once again, I think the idea was, hey, you want to be a priest? Sure. All right, you're in. It was kind of like that, probably. Question. Since Jeroboam set up this new priesthood, what do you think happened to the Levites who had been Israel's priests before? And what did Yahweh's true believers, true followers do who lived in the northern kingdom? Well, it just so turns out that 2 Chronicles actually gives us the answer to that. So the parallel passages in 2 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 11, gives us the answer. It reads this. The priests and Levites from all their districts throughout Israel sided with Rehoboam. The Levites even abandoned their pasture lands and property and came to Judah and Jerusalem because Jeroboam and his sons had rejected them as priests of the Lord. And he appointed his own priests for the high places and for the goat and calf idols he had made. Those from every tribe of Israel who set their hearts on seeking the Lord, the God of Israel, followed the Levites to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices to the Lord, the God of their fathers. They strengthened the kingdom of Judah and supported Rehoboam, son of Solomon, 3 years, walking in the ways of David and Solomon during his lifetime. So then, Not only did Jeroboam install new priests who would be loyal to him, but he also kicked out God's true priests, the Levites, who moved to Judah. And following them to Judah were the rest of the true worshipers of Yahweh who continued to travel to Jerusalem to worship at the temple. Together, the Levites and the true worshipers strengthened Rehoboam in the true temple worship of Yahweh at Judah, in Jerusalem and Judah. So, we have new high places throughout Israel and a bunch of new priests. What else? Jeroboam also initiated his own religious festival to compete with God's sanctioned festival of tabernacles, which was observed at the temple in Jerusalem. And he set it on a date exactly 1 month after that festival. So there was all kinds of new stuff. It was time for out with the old, in with the new. It was a complete overhaul of pretty much everything. Now, surely God was impressed with Jeroboam's jazzy new religion, right? What do you think? Don't think so? You don't think God was favorably impressed with all this? There must have been a lot of people in Israel who were impressed with it. It's kind of like nowadays. You got these new things that go on in Christianity people get all excited about, and you think, I wonder what God really thinks about that. Well, a lot of times we know what God thinks about a lot of it. Let's keep reading in chapter 13. By the word of the Lord, a man of God came from Judah to Bethel as Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make an offering. He cried against the altar by the word of the Lord. O altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. So he's speaking to the altar. A son named Josiah will be born to the house of David. On you he will sacrifice the priests of the high places. High places who now make offerings here, and human bones will be burned on you. That same day, the man of God gave a sign. This is the sign the Lord has declared. The altar will be split apart, and the ashes on it will be poured out. When King Jeroboam heard what the man of God cried out against the altar at Bethel, he stretched out his hand from the altar and said, "Seize him!" But the hand he stretched out toward the man shriveled up so that he could not pull it back. It must have been quite a sight. Also, the altar was split apart and its ashes poured out according to the sign given by the man of God by the word of the Lord. Then the king was in a little bit more humble mood. The king said to the man of God, "Intercede with the Lord your God." Notice he doesn't call Yahweh his God. You notice that? No, he's the Lord your God. Jeroboam knew that he was not a true worshiper of the Lord. "Intercede with Yahweh your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored." So the man of God interceded with Yahweh, and the king's hand was restored and became as it was before. The king said to the man of God, "Come home with me and have something to eat, and I will give you a gift." Why do you think Jeroboam wanted the man to go home with him? Do you remember when Samuel condemned the sin of Saul? What did Saul want? He wanted a little photo op, right? "Why don't you come with me and so everybody can see that you're really okay with everything?" And Samuel said, "No, God's not okay with everything. He's condemning this." Well, that's what's really going on here. See, Jeroboam is concerned with his public image and with the image of his new worship system. So even though he has now been told that Yahweh rejects this system, he wants to claim to everyone else that Yahweh is still okay with it. In their culture, to go to someone's house and to eat with them communicated that you are okay with who they are and with what they are doing. So if the prophet eats with Jeroboam, then Jeroboam can claim that Yahweh is really okay with his new religious system. Well, Yahweh wasn't okay with his new system. Look at verse 18. The man of God answered the king, "Even if you were to give me half your possessions, I would not go with you, nor would I eat bread or drink water here. For I was commanded by the word of the Lord, you must not eat bread or drink water or return by the way you came." So he took another road and did not return by the way he had come to Bethel. And of course, if you read the whole passage, you see that after this, the prophet made a mistake. He listened to a lying prophet, a prophet who gave him false information, and he believed him, and he went to his place and ate. And as a result, God had this prophet killed because he had disobeyed the Lord. He accepted that other prophet's word over the word he heard directly from God. Also, once again, shows us that we need to listen to God directly through the word of God and not listen to others who try to claim to speak for God when they don't. Now skip down to verse 33. Coming down the home stretch here. Verse 33. Even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways, but once more appointed priests for the high places from all sorts of people. Anyone who wanted to become a priest, he consecrated for the high places. This was the sin of the house of Jeroboam that led to its downfall and to its destruction from the face of the earth. What was the sin of Jeroboam? In one word, it was syncretism. A paganized worship of Yahweh, which deviated from the Lord's system, which God had commanded through the law of Moses. It was this replacement of God's system, which God had set up in Judah. Okay, what did Jeroboam add? He had not one city of worship, Jerusalem, but two cities, Bethel and Dan. He did not have one temple, but two main places of worship, along with lesser important sites on high places throughout the land. He did not have one priestly tribe, the Levites, but he had priests from various tribes. And he did not have God's feast, the Feast of Tabernacles, but a rival festival that Jeroboam himself had created. But most of all, he did not have the true worship of the invisible God Yahweh, but a counterfeit which can be represented by a golden calf. He did not have the system prescribed by Yahweh in the law, but he had a different one that he himself had established. Why? All in the name of convenience, and all to protect Jeroboam's throne. So then, how does Jeroboam's newfangled religion work out? Come back next Sunday. We're going to look at that, and we'll go into detail there.